I'm Paul Harris, filling in for Dave Ross. Thank you for listening. News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM. Let me introduce you to Tony Hendra. Tony has a pretty good comedy resume, going back to his days as part of a comedy team on the 60s, where they appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. In the late 60s and early 70s, he was part of the National Lampoon gang that created a terrific Broadway show called Lemmings. He was the original editor of the National Lampoon. He has written lots and lots of books, and many people will also recognize him as Ian Faith, the manager of the world's greatest rock band, in the movie This Is Spinal Tap. He was also very close friends with George Carlin, and for 15 years or so, they worked on what would eventually become the George Carlin biography that has just been published posthumously about a year and a half after George's death. It's called Last Words, and I've asked Tony to join me here today to talk about it. Hi, Tony. How are you?
Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing just great. First of all, congratulations on all of your work and on the book. And secondly, tell me how the project began in 1993.
Well, it actually began probably even before that, because George and I were we were comedians together in the mid-60s in the village. We were scuffling around the same kind of places trying to get on television, and formed a kind of friendship then, a sort of, you know, friendly competitors sort of friendship. And we did very much the same kind of nightclubs like Mr. Kelly's in Chicago and the Hungry Eye in San Francisco. And we did the same awful, you know, 60s variety television shows like the Ed Sullivan Show, which was just a graveyard of laughs for comedians. And in fact, so bad that we used to call it Night of the Living Ed. So we went through the same kind of torments that young comedians went through in those days, and we sort of lost touch with one another when we went in separate directions in the 70s, and then came back together again for a project I was doing, which was a book about modern American satire called Going Too Far. And by then, in the mid-80s, George was in the top rank of people that I wanted to interview for it, and we really hit it off in our interviews. And when he got the autobiography bug a few years later and found it harder than he'd expected, he asked me if I could give him a hand. So for the next, and as you say, in 93, roughly, we began working on this in a series of wonderful, wild, hilarious, and often moving conversations, which either in taped form or in just purely verbal form, went on really for the next 15 years.
And was he talking about his life in the present tense, or did he also talk about flashbacks all the way to his youth and his early days there on Night of the Living Ed, as you call it?
Well, actually, I don't know if you've had a chance to glance at the book, but the book actually begins with his conception, typical George Carlin, obviously.
Yep.
And so it goes, yes, it goes about as far back as you can possibly go.
Now, tell me a little bit about George's morphing from that Ed Sullivan-ready comedian of the 60s, doing material that, you know, was fairly standard material, let's be honest, and then morphing into the long-haired counterculture comedian of the 70s who really took off and changed the world of comedy. Were you around for some of that?
Well, my version of that actually was the National Lampoon, which represented just as big a changeover humor-wise from what I'd been doing on the Ed Sullivan Show and the Merv Griffin Show, as George's changeover too. George obviously became much more famous much more quickly, but we both went through very much the same kind of transformation, if that's what it is. I mean, it was also a bit like emerging, you know, the moth emerging from the chrysalis. But what really was significant about the television, which that era of television, which I think everyone has forgotten, is that it was immensely, especially for comedians, it was immensely censored. You couldn't, as a comedian, talk about anything that was going on in the late 60s, such as Vietnam and civil rights and the women's movement and the sexual revolution and drugs. All of this stuff was just completely verboten. And it was tremendously frustrating for young comedians like us to have to constantly do these kind of pieces that George did, and I did the same kind of pieces, where you would just be doing safe material, you know, George's. I mean, it's wonderful. George was wonderful at this, much better than my partner and I were at it, and that's why he had such a stellar, if brief, career in 60s television. Pieces like Wonderful Wino and Al Sleet, the Hippy Dippy Weatherman, were just very, very funny. They were very funny versions, though, of this kind of safe material that we all had to do. And it was, as I say, for young comedians, it was immensely frustrating, and for George no less than anyone else. And he just rebelled openly against it. I mean, he was he actually was playing Vegas by then, and he began using not exactly the words that you can never say on television, but some of those words in Vegas, and was fired several times from these huge gigs that he had. And he reemerged by really going back to his own roots, which I thought was quite wonderful. He grew up in New York in an area of Harlem known as White Harlem, because it was all Irish. And he grew up Catholic, and he grew up a real rebel. You know, he was kicked out of every school he went into. When he was in the Air Force, he got a total of 3 court-martials in the couple of years he was in. So, you know, he went back to these kind of rebellious roots, and that's what produced these wonderful albums like Class Clown and Occupation Fool, where he, you know, I used to be an Irish Catholic, was this extended routine about his relations, that all Catholics really identified with, I think, in those days. And then, of course, this seminal piece called, which was really the summed up what he had to say about the 60s television, which was the 7 words you could never say on television, and defined the whole sort of face-off between the counterculture and, you know, official America's strongest, most powerful voice.
Talking with Tony Hendra, who's the co-author of George Carlin's autobiography, Last Words, and while we're on the 7 dirty words, I don't want to go through the legal part and the Supreme Court and all of that, because it's been rehashed so many times, but I did not know one of the stories that you have in here that George tells about being arrested in Milwaukee at Summerfest for for essentially, you know, saying those words on stage. Would you share that story and what his real fear was that night?
Well, it's as we said to one another when he first told me that story, these are the 7 words you can't say on television, and you can't say them in Milwaukee either. what happened essentially was that I think this is in 1973, and George was doing something called Summerfest, which is down by the lake there in Milwaukee, a big, enormous kind of summer county fair, really, and he was part of the entertainment, and they had very large speakers that carried the sounds of the entertainment way beyond the actual concert shell. So there were 100,000 people down there, and only 2,000 or 3,000 of them were at the concert. So the other 47,000 heard the 7 words you could never say on television or in Milwaukee. And somebody complained to the police, and the police decided that they had to arrest George as soon as he'd finished his act. And what made this rather difficult was that this was probably right at the beginning, or maybe I should say the crest, of George's cocaine use. So on his in his blue denim jacket that he wore, he was carrying a fair amount of a highly illegal drug. And so... but obviously he couldn't sort of pass that off to anyone on stage or attempt to drop it over the footlights or something. I mean, there was no way, since he was up there in the public eye, that he could possibly possibly fool the police about that. So his wife came on and told him about the situation, and there was an arrangement made whereby they would make it look as if he was coming off one side, and the cops would obviously congregate there, and instead he went off the other side and gave his jacket to one of the band members who were opening for him, who thereby got a good couple of $1,000 worth of drugs. and luckily he was only busted for you know, disorderly conduct, I think, was the charge. But this, these are the kind of great stories that you always came across when you were with George. I mean, he had a whole slew of them.
We'll come back and talk more about the late, great George Carlin in a moment with Tony Hendra, the co-author of George's autobiography, Last Words. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Dave Ross Show on News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM.
So what will happen to the man that paid some teenagers to spit, slap, and punch him in the face? You paid him $31. We'll talk about it at 3:06 this afternoon. It's Ron and Don. We'll get you to the driveway right here on 97.3 FM.
I'm Paul Harris, filling in for Dave Ross and talking with Tony Hendra, who co-authored George Carlin's autobiography, released posthumously this month. It's called Last Words. George, of course, died in June of last year. And Tony, I'd like to talk about a paragraph here on page 237, in which George talks about a comedy boom being in full swing during the 80s.
Right.
And the book says, quote, "I was always being told about the hot new guy or the hot new woman. I'd sometimes tense up internally because you never know. It's like gunfighting in the old West. New guy in town. Might be faster than you. I'm the big guy on the block, or at least one of them, so they're coming after me. I've always been very competitive about that. But they also come and go, so I was always slow to rush out and catch them. I didn't obsess about the competition as some guys do, but when a stand-up starts breaking from the pack, you have to check them out." I had never thought of comedy as a competitive game this way. Is it?
I think it's probably one of the most competitive things on earth, actually. Once you get two comedians together, you know, that makes the free market look like socialism. And if you get more than two around a table, I mean, there's nothing like that. What he's talking about specifically is this enormous, as everybody knows, I'm sure, this enormous phenomenal growth of stand-up comedy in the 80s, and the fact that he always was very, very aware of, amongst many other things, he was a supreme professional when it came to his art, his craft. And part of that, obviously, is staying ahead of anyone who might look like a competitor. And in this particular case, the only person he saw at that time in the mid 80s who really threatened his didn't threaten him but was going to give him a good run for his money was Sam Kinison. And Sam, as he put it, was smart, he was loud, he was aggressive, and that made George actually realize that he too had to get smarter, louder, and more aggressive. And it did in fact, I think it helped create this extraordinary artist who emerged in the early 90s, I think probably one of the greatest comedians in the English language that's ever lived, because of this, you know, because of this sort of prodding by younger, faster, louder comedians.
And so he changed his act because of Sam?
I don't think he changed his act. No, his act was expanding by then in its own organic way. But I think what he did do was I realized that I had to become, I had to increase the volume, as he put it, there was a greater violence of language, which doesn't necessarily mean that you're espousing violence. It just means that the choice of words is that much edgier and grittier and rougher. And because that combined in George with this really tremendous intellect and great comic sense of the absurdity. I mean, the absurdity of the universe, not just the absurdity of naval lint, but the really big things that he liked to talk about. Because those two things were present in him, I think that's what made him unique.
Carlin got the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor a couple of years ago, just a few months before he died. Did he care about that? And did he care about awards?
Not really. I mean, I think he was. I think he was that particular one, since it had a literary flair. I think meant more to him than most of them. But he used to say, you know, I mean, awards are not. I'm not doing this in order to get awards. In fact, what when these awards started to flow in the late 90s and the early part of this decade, he said, "What can I do so that they won't give me an award?" You know. So he had a kind of, I mean, as I think a number of great artists do, a kind of ambiguous reaction to awards. It was obviously they're nice to have and good for the what he called the superficial ego, the ego that needs stroking. But on the other hand, that isn't. If people start giving you awards because of what you write and say and do, it probably means you're not going far enough yet.
The book is a great look. The book is a great look at one of the greatest comedians ever, George Carlin. The autobiography is called Last Words. Tony Hendra, his longtime friend, helped put it together about a year and a half after George's death. And I thank you for coming on and sharing some of the stories here today.
Not at all. It was great fun.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Dave Ross Show. Thanks for listening. Dory's up next on News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM.